Yes. Yes, 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 dude. Welcome back. Welcome back to the show, you guys. Everybody, y'all, my friends, the Blanket Nation. Been doing this podcast for a minute now. Been doing this podcast for 2.5 years. Actually, close to 3 years. No, God, really close to 3 years. In November, it's going to be 3 years. My God. And I've done a lot of good episodes. I'm really proud of this podcast. And I'm glad that those of you who listen to it come back week after week. I don't say this every week. You know this. If you're a person who listens to this podcast every week, you know that I don't regularly say this. And the reason I don't say it is because I don't want any of my other guests to feel bad. I don't want anybody to feel like I think that their episode wasn't great. I've been proud of all the episodes. I'm happy I get to have the conversations that I get to have on this show. It's a great excuse for me to talk to very interesting people. It's a great excuse for me to have a very in-depth conversation with people that I'm close with and who I love and respect. And, you know, like last week I got to have my best friend, Wit in here talking about forgiveness. And it was a very special and tender conversation between two friends. And I really, really, value that. And I hope you got value out of it. But I have to say every once in a while, I'll be doing an episode of the show and I'll be like in the back of my mind while I'm having the conversation with the person thinking, this is a special one. We're hitting on a lot of good stuff here. This person came to play today. And yesterday, when I was recording this conversation with my guest today, I had the thought, this is the best episode of this show I've ever done. This is the best episode of People Pleaser so far. I just feel so incredibly fortunate to have met this guest. I met him totally by chance at a party. And standing on a rooftop, we bumped into each other and just got into a conversation. And man, does he have a story to tell. I don't want to give it away. I want you to hear it in the interview. But it's a fantastic story. It's a story. It's a miraculous story. It's a stranger than fiction story in many ways. It's an inspiring story. Man, this guy has so much to offer. I really, really am so honored and blessed to have met this person, and I'm so excited to share a little bit of his story and a little bit of his light with you today. Before we do that, okay, we're going to get into it. Before we do that, I want to do a quick little bad take brigade, okay? So how about some down, down, the bad take brigade? It's the bad take brigade. It's where we look on the internet and look in the world and the zeitgeist and find bad takes. So let's just get this bad taste out of our mouths before we get into a very inspiring conversation. President Biden had a State of the Union address. I'll say this. I don't know what the team was thinking with the lighting. I'll give that to the detractors and the critics. It was weird lighting. It was like these like ominous red lights behind him, flanked by the military. I don't know what the idea was there. It seems very intentionally evocative of like authoritarian imagery. I just was like, weird choice, guys. Weird choice. That being said, the content of the speech, I was like, yeah. And it obviously pissed a lot of people off. He basically just spent a good portion of the speech calling out the extremism on the right, and particularly the threat that MAGA Republicans pose to our republic and to our democracy and to the country, which is just a very real thing. And it was actually really refreshing for a guy who has spent so much of his time, both in the campaign process and as president, not really directly addressing the fact that we have a real problem in this country with growing extremism and people who are becoming more and more detached from reality. He's really tried to like not directly address that so much. And he has a long history of kind of playing politic when it comes to being direct in stuff like that. It was refreshing to have him just say directly to the nation, we got a big problem with extremism and people who are sort of actively denying reality and people who are actively planning on undermining our democracy and undermining future elections and are doing it in plain view. They are right now trying to elect people at the state level who are vowing to overthrow elections that don't go their way. This is a serious problem and a threat to the stability of our country and to the stability of our democratic process, to the integrity of our democratic process. It's a real, real serious problem. And it was nice to have him address it. But of course, the consequence naturally of that is going to be outrage and pearl clutching from the right, which is just hilarious. It's hilarious and insane from people who are so openly vitriolic and like ugly and mean with their language on a regular basis, people who have no problem being just the most effusive with their hate and their vitriol in their, like, it is like a staple of the identity of the modern American right to be as gross and mean and hate-filled with your language as possible, because they know that, like, they really believe that language is the battleground of the culture war, that, like, the fact that we don't want them to say hate slurs and to refer to marginalized and historically disenfranchised communities with hate slurs, they view that as like us controlling their speech. So they go out of their way to fill their language with as much, with as many slurs and as many, and it's all under the auspices of like freedom of speech. Don't tell me what to do, which is funny too, because they love censoring people's speech and, you know, they love burning books and banning books and telling teachers what they can and can't say in schools and trying to control the language of educators so that we don't have to address things like slavery being bad or the Holocaust being bad or trans and gay people existing, you know, really trying to control people's speech in that vein. But if we tell them, hey, can you not use that language that's really harmful to this historically marginalized and disenfranchised community, they're like, don't tell me what to say, I have freedom of speech. These are people who, it is such a staple of their identity to be rude people, to be mean people, to be provocative people. And when the president of the United States calls them what they are, which is extremists who are threatening to undermine our democracy, which is just literally true of these people, they do it in it's not a secret. It's not like they are doing this out in the open. The pearl clutching from these people, the like, I can't believe he would say that about us, he's attacking us, is just either a total lack of self-awareness, or it's just more them openly lying, knowing that they're lying, pretending like they're victims because it serves their agenda to pose as victims. I don't really understand why they do what they do, to be honest. I have theories, but I've never really understood like why these people are so committed to being disingenuous in everything that they do. Anyway, here is former White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, the White House Press Secretary for Donald Trump, sharing her thoughts on why what Joe Biden said was so terrible and how her former boss, ex-President Donald Trump, never would have done anything like that.
My former boss was a counterpuncher. There's no doubt about that. You look at what he said, you attack him, he attacks you. If you go back and look at his attacks, almost all of them, 99.9%, maybe 100%, were against a person who has attacked him, were against a politician. They were not against a group of people. The White House did not set out on a campaign to attack half the country. I did not stand at the podium and say, you Joe Biden, Build Back America people, we hate you. I didn't do that. Karine Jean-Pierre stands at the podium nearly daily and talks about the MAGA Republicans. This is a sustained campaign from the chief of staff, press secretary, president, against half the country. You don't believe me? He said that the Republican Party is dominated and driven by Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans. What does dominated mean? It means taken over. It means more than half. And then today he comes out, tries to clean it up. I don't consider any Trump supporters a threat to the country. Really? Well, you said that last night, Mr. Split Personality, because I watched it, by the way, in a room full of MAGA Republicans who all heard very clearly what you thought of us and the rest of the country. Okay, so
Like, come on, dude. You're going to go on national television and tell me with a straight face that your former boss, Donald J. Trump, is a counterpuncher who only lashes out at people who lash out at him first, that he's never said a mean thing about anyone who didn't say something mean about him first? For real. For real. You're going to go on TV and tell all of us who watched his campaign process in 2015 and 2016, who watched the strategy of his campaign being, I'm just going to come up with little kid nicknames for all of my opponents, including Republicans. I'm going to call him Little Marco. I'm going to make fun of Ted Cruz and say that his wife is ugly. I'm going to I'm going to say that I can't remember the name of the Fox News correspondent, but I'm gonna say she was on the rag, that she was on her period, and that's why she was bleeding out of her eyes and out of her you know where. I'm gonna brag about my dick size on a debate stage. I'm gonna say, like, well, my hands aren't that small, and that's not the only thing that's not small about me. Like, you're gonna, this man, this crass man who mocked a disabled journalist simply for being disabled. Like, 2 weeks ago, guys, 2 weeks ago, this dude was at a rally where, first of all, it's a little bit concerning. He said that he still lived in the White House, and that was weird. This is what this guy said 2 weeks ago. He was on stage, and he goes, the other day, weirdo, he's a weirdo, Mark Zuckerberg, he's a big weirdo, he came to eat at the White House, and he said, sir, I really want to be in business with you. I really do. I really want to be in business with you. Like, it's such a weird story. First of all, because, like, you don't live at the White House anymore. Do you know that? Do you know that you don't live at the White House anymore? Are you aware of that? And second of all, like, why are you – I'm not here to defend Mark Zuckerberg or say that, like, we should lay off Mark Zuckerberg. We don't need to, like, come to the defense of Mark Zuckerberg. But how weird that he's talking about a guy who apparently likes him. Mark Zuckerberg, who, like, was having dinner with him and trying to be nice to him. So Kayleigh McEnany saying that Trump is a counterpuncher. He's only mean to people who are mean to him first. In his story, he's saying Mark Zuckerberg came over to my house, the White House, which is not where he lives. And he was kissing my ass. That's what he says in the story. He goes, kissed my ass, told me, sir, I'd love. So he's saying that, like, Mark Zuckerberg is being very nice to him. But he announces at the beginning of the story that Mark Zuckerberg is a weirdo to the whole audience at this rally. Weirdo, total weirdo. He's a weirdo, folks. But it's like, this is who this man is. There's no mystery about this. Anyone in the world knows that Donald Trump is a mean person, is a bully of a person. It's what MAGA Republicans and voters on the right like about him. They like that he's openly vitriolic like them. They like that he hits first, that he does not require provocation to be mean. That is like the idea. And you're going on TV and telling us that he's a counterpuncher and that he never would say anything this mean? He would never be as rude as Joe Biden was? And President Biden is still a diplomat and a politician. Even the way that he spoke about the MAGA Republicans, he did it like a politician. He did it like a diplomat. He spoke about it as though it was a serious national security threat, as though it was a serious threat to the security of the nation. He spoke like a professional. He didn't get up and go like, these MAGA Republicans are a bunch of morons, idiots. Aren't they a bunch of ugly? Look at these ugly people, folks. I mean, he did do that at a rally recently where someone was interrupting him and he said, everyone's entitled to be an idiot. He did say that. But, like, on stage of the State of the Union, he was like, he spoke like a president. He spoke like a diplomat. And the only thing I wish he hadn't done is he took it back the next day. He was kind of like, oh, I didn't mean that. I think that most Republicans are fine. I wish he hadn't walked it back. You were right the first time, President Biden. One more thing. So just one more thing in this bad take brigade, and then we'll get into the interview. That goes along with just sort of this weird gaslighting that these people do, where they try to tell us that Donald Trump isn't a rude person who lashes out at people without provocation. This is Tommy Lahren, another one of these blonde female correspondents on Fox News. You know, that's like the requirement. You have to be like a white blonde woman. And they all look the same, and I can't ever tell them apart. But Tommy Lahren, this is Tommy Lahren on Fox and Friends, describing to us what a MAGA Republican is.
I just want to explain to those that aren't familiar of what a MAGA Republican is, because I don't think the Democrats, I don't think Joe Biden has it straight. A MAGA Republican is not an extremist. It's not somebody who denies elections. A MAGA Republican is somebody who loves their country, loves their family, wants their country to come first, loves law enforcement, loves the military. It's those forgotten Americans in the heartland of our country that work hard every single day, don't ask for much from anybody, do their thing, want the government to be as small as possible, and they united behind Donald Trump because he brought that message.
Again, the unmitigated audacity to go on TV and tell America, I mean, obviously, you're only speaking to conservative America on Fox News, but, like, this is going to make its way to the internet and made its way to me, to tell the American populace on national TV and on a clip that's going to be cut out and put on Twitter that MAGA Republicans are not, and I quote, are not extremists or election deniers. How absolutely dare you? Like, where do you get the fucking balls to say something like that? As though that hasn't been the entire storyline of the last 3 years. These people are not extremists and are not election deniers. Where do you get off saying something like that? How dare you? How dare you say something like that? That these people are not extremists and are not election deniers.
If for nothing else, like, you just proved everything President Biden said on the stage about you right. That you are divorced from reality and that you are a threat to our republic because you refuse to engage in actual reality. I mean, I watch stuff like this and I'm like, who is it for? Who is the lie for? It's not for me. It's definitely not for anybody on the left or anybody left of center, probably not even anybody in the center. Like, anybody with any shred of reasonability in their mind, if you hear someone say MAGA Republicans are not election deniers, goes, well, that's bullshit. Not just because I have a good bullshit meter, but because I've literally watched these people deny election results every day for the last 2+ years. So that's just not true. That's a lie. Who is this lie for? Is it for the conservative Fox News viewers? And are they like, what are we? I said earlier, I don't know why these people do what they do. And when I try to understand it, it becomes all the more baffling and frustrating because I'm like, are they convincing themselves and each other? Like, hey guys, we're not extremists. We're not election deniers. Even though they've built their entire identity on being election deniers and on like pushing an agenda openly that they want to turn America into a Christian nationalist state, which is an extremist position. Like that they are openly extremists that are pushing for Christian nationalism, that their enemies are Antifa, you know, the anti-fascists. So President Joe Biden calls them semi-fascists, that's like kind of nice because they are openly fascistic. And then they go on national television and say, we're not election deniers or extremists. We're just hardworking people who love our country. What are you talking about? Who is this for? Who are you lying for? Who is this for? Why are we doing this? I made a TikTok like a year and a half ago or something where it was all about like this exact situation where a person is like insisting that they're not racist, even though everything that they're saying is coded in racism. And it ends with the person on the left going like, what are we doing here? Like, I know you're racist. You know you're racist. You know that I know you're racist. I know that you know that I know. Who is this for? Why do you keep insisting that you're not racist? Why can't we just speak openly about our conflicting positions? And the person just responds, I'm not racist because I continue to insist that I'm not. And it's like, yeah, I still don't to this day fully understand it. I really don't understand why we can't just be honest about this. I don't understand what the utility of Tommy Lahren saying we're not election deniers. What's that for? Because you are. You just are. Okay. So that's the worst the vibes are going to get today. Okay. That's the worst the vibes are going to get. We have a great conversation coming up on this show. I'm so excited for you to hear it. Thank you for bearing with me through those icky vibes. Thank you for gritting and bearing it. I'm trying to find a way to view these people with more compassion and with more empathy and with more humanity. And I want to do that. And maybe people like my guest today, Christian Branscombe, can help me out with that. You know, and continuing on working on myself and focusing on what I can control, which is just me and my reaction to the ride that I'm on and my relationship to my emotions, my relationship to my shame, to my anger, to my fear, all those things. Maybe through that work, I can start to view these people with a more compassionate, more humanistic lens. Excellent guest on the show today. Very, very excited for this conversation. Christian Branscombe is a life coach who coaches people on things from shame to overcoming trauma and everything in between. He's an excellent artist, and I'm so thrilled that I met this person so that I could bring this conversation to you all. I will give a brief, teensiest, tiniest of trigger warnings. This, I promise you, this conversation does not get very graphic or like overly descriptive of anything, but we do discuss violent crime. We do discuss in a little bit just a violent crime that took place, and that's all I'll say. But it's not like a true crime podcast where we're going to like go into graphic detail of what the crime scene looked like and all that stuff. I just wanted to give that up at the top. I'm so thrilled to have this guest on. I hope you really enjoy this conversation. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my new friend, Christian Branscombe, about shame. All right, dude. Christian, I'm thrilled to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
You are just the second person to be in the newly renovated Blanket Fort recording studio. You saw that sign that says Blanket Fort behind you there.
Right.
When my audience is probably really, really bored of me telling this story, but when I first started this podcast, we would be out in that room. People would come over to this apartment, and I would have like a little room divider and an air mattress, and I would put like a blanket up to block, because it's a very high ceilinged apartment. It's very echoey, and you know, I had to do what I could to try to contain the sound a little bit, but we were literally like in a blanket fort.
Wow.
And then over the years, I've renovated this room to being more like an actual recording studio. And the final piece was I got that sign, and you are now the second person to be back in person.
Wow!
So I'm thrilled to have you here.
Well, it's my honor to be in here. Definitely, I'm glad to be a part of it, because this is a cool non-blanket fort right here. Very nice.
Yeah, it has like the energy though, right?
It does. It has a cool space. It really does. It has a like, nice vibe to it.
Of a blanket fort. Yeah. Like you feel cozy and comfortable.
I am cozy.
Yeah. Good. I'm really excited to talk about this topic, because it's been coming up a lot in my life recently. I recently did a cord cutting ceremony. Do you know what that is?
No, I don't.
It's it's kind of like a witchy, very woo-woo thing that I did with my sister-in-law, Lissandra. She asked me, she just asked me, she was like, do you want to do a cord cutting ceremony? And I was like, I don't know what that is, but I think so. I was like, yeah, I do. Yeah,
sounds cool.
I've been struggling. This year's big struggle has been like, my anxiety has really made a return over the last couple of years. And this year I've really dug in on like, what's going on and how can I address this? Because I don't like that this is so prominent in my life again. And I was talking to my sister-in-law and my brother about like, I was on the verge of a panic attack, and she just goes, do you want to come over tomorrow and do a cord cutting ceremony? And I was like, yeah, sure. I'll try anything, you know? Sure. And essentially what it is it's just sort of like a ceremonious separating from a particular narrative or something that you're carrying with you, something that's not really serving you anymore. And, my big narratives that weren't serving me anymore centered around feeling a lot of shame about my fear. And that's something that I've only recently started to understand, is like, oh, I have like deep-rooted from childhood embarrassment and shame about having panic attacks and about being such a fearful person and about not being braver than I would like to be. You know, this goes back to like not wanting to ride roller coasters and stuff as a little kid, you know, like stuff that isn't uncommon for a child, but I had other friends who were willing to ride roller coasters and willing to be, you know, braver on their bikes and braver on like skateboards and things like that. And I was always very fearful and very trepidatious. And I had a lot of shame about that. I wanted to be a bolder person. And I realize I'm carrying that into my adulthood, that like, I don't deal with my fear well. I deal with it with a lot of embarrassment and shame. And I get very upset when I get afraid or when I start experiencing anxiety. And so I was trying to sever ties with sort of that narrative of like, my fear is something I should be ashamed of. I should be like embarrassed about. Because, you know, it is embarrassing as a 34-year-old man when I have a panic attack in public. Like, it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's always the fact that it's such a small idea and so overwhelming that makes it even more shameful, right? It's like something, when something seems small, but yet it really affects us so deeply, it feels like it's even more overwhelming because of that, you know? And that's the way shame kind of functions. It's definitely in that pocket.
Absolutely. I should be able to, at this point in my life, go to the dentist. You know, I understand that, like, this person does this 20 times a day, every day, and they're not going to like slip and drill through my cheek and put a hole, you know, like, it's like, I don't need to be afraid of that.
Right.
But there's something about that loss of control or that surrendering of control that I still really struggle with.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell sort of the audience here a little bit about the work that you do when in shame and coaching other people with shame sort of how that operates and just sort of the work that you're doing right now. And then we'll talk a little bit about how you got into that work.
Well, it sounds like your cord cutting ceremony in a lot of ways. You know, I come to the practice through my own experience, kind of going through my life, trying to heal myself and really taking an honest look at who I was and who I wanted to be and the things that were impacting me and were something that really drove me to affect other people either for the worst or for the better. And that led over the years, I mean, decades of work, working on myself to where I became somebody that helped other people process their trauma. Mm-hmm. They got to a place to where they could look at things that they thought they couldn't face or couldn't really manage in their lives. And so I work with people that are conflicted with shame and overwhelmed with trauma, whether it be childhood or adult or situational, and really try to help people change that narrative and explore just about any avenue that really brings them to a state of empowerment, well-being, and purpose in their lives.
Amazing. Now, you happen to be, I mean, you talked about you. It comes from your story that, and like, I met you on a rooftop several weeks ago, just at this thing, and you asked me what I do, and I was like, oh, I'm an online content creator, like actor, musician guy. I asked you what you do. You're like, oh, you know, I do like life coaching and stuff like that. I was like, oh, how'd you get into that? And I just was not prepared for your response. I wonder if you get that often, that when you tell people how you got into it, they're like, wait, what'd you just say?
I do get that kind of like deer in the headlights look, like, what just happened? You know, everything just shifted in this conversation. And, you know, and fortunately and unfortunately, I don't wear my past. So it's a little shocking if I don't divulge it, and I purposely do share it with people so that they don't get caught off guard as we become friends, because I don't want them to feel untrusting, you know.
Sure.
But it is a difficult subject to bring up, and it does have a wide range of responses. You know, a lot of people have life history that you wouldn't expect, and
right.
So for me, coming from at 19, I committed first degree murder. Mm-hmm. I was sentenced at 21 years old to life without the possibility of parole, meaning I wasn't going to be released.
That's it.
You're dying in prison. That's what's going to happen. And I spent 25 years in prison. Came home almost to the day 3 years ago. And it's in large, you know, the governor commuted my sentence. And that was the reason why I was allowed to come home, was because...
How does that happen? Like, what is the process for that?
Well, I mean, it's one of the... It's an absolute act of mercy, in the sense that I was condemned to die by the justice system, to die in prison. And the only way I could have come home was with the governor choosing to send me home. And so he looked at the way I was doing my time, the people that endorsed me, the potential impact I could have on the community coming home, the commitment offense, And, you know, he just gave me an amazing opportunity to give back, you know, to help, you know, stem the tide that exists in our communities where people that are traumatized don't get the opportunity to really have support and interconnection in that journey.
Is that a thing that's happening more common lately? Like, is that a thing that more states are doing and more governors are doing? Or is that a kind of rare thing that you were given?
It's a very rare thing. And up until then, Jerry Brown, he commuted a lot of people at the time that I was getting commuted. But in the history of California, that was the first time that somebody that wasn't in law enforcement got a commutation, period. And then especially somebody that was life without the possibility of parole, that's absolutely unheard of. It's unheard of. So when I say I'm fortunate, I mean, it's like on the miraculous level of the spectrum. You know, it's not something I ever in life expected to happen.
I think it almost, it most certainly says a lot about the way that you were doing your time and the way that, and the things that you were spending your, you know, pouring your energy into while you were on the inside. Yeah. And I think that sort of also informed the work that you're doing now, but it certainly, like, it was obvious to the people who were in charge of what happens with your life that you were, had been for years, very committed to this, like, very, like, strong work and rehabilitative work. At what point, you know, I don't want to spend too much time in the deep dark recesses. Like, I feel like we could do an entire conversation just about the prison system and just about, like, America's rehabilitative system. But this conversation is about shame. At what point in the 25 years, it's a long time, I mean, is there a period where you're just upset, angry, depressed, despondent, and I view this very, like, Andy Dufresne style of, like, there's got to be the period of, like, oh my God, how has it come to this? And at what point do you start shifting into what can I do to be a positive force in here?
Well, you know, I think there's layers to it. I would say that for me, it came down to, I'm going to die in prison. And I think that you have to really come to terms with the way that you've been trying to do things doesn't work, right? So they always talk about that proverbial hitting the bottom or, you know, like, but it really comes down to the way that you've been coping with your shame no longer is effective. Mm-hmm. It never gives you that break because it's really an addiction cycle. It's synonymous with it. You know, an addiction cycle, a shame cycle, a trauma cycle, they're all the same thing. You know, you do something nasty and for a minute you don't feel weak and then you circle back around and then you start feeling insecure again and then you double down on it and you keep doing it harder and more and you just spiral out into this really negative impact in your life and others. Well, in prison, you're surrounded with, you know, 1,000 other guys that are doing the same thing you're doing. And after about a decade in prison, you start to really wonder, what is my purpose? What is it that I'm going to do? And you really just come to, you know, like almost like a self-awareness that you're miserable. You know, like there's nothing that brings you joy. You are distanced from the community. You're losing all of your connections and you really have to ask yourself hard questions. And so I slowly started, you know, I got into Buddhism and started meditating a lot. I got into studying and, you know, just endlessly about, you know, psychology, philosophy, theology, and just tried to, like, what is my purpose and what is it that I'm going to do that hopefully mitigates some of the things that I've done in my life. And in that journey, it took probably 5 or 6 years of really doing a lot of soul searching and asking myself those very questions to where every time I got to a root issue, it was always about shame. Mm-hmm. It was always about this feeling that I didn't feel connected. I didn't feel worthy. I didn't feel safe. Yeah. I didn't feel like I was actually connected to other people.
Yeah.
And there was this barrier between me and them. And the way that shame works, or the language of shame, isn't that that connection isn't available. It's that you can't receive it. Because if shame comes from without, but then I adopt it as my philosophy or my narrative, there's some part of me that says, yeah, you're being nice to me right now. You're being kind. You're even offering me to help me and do things and to be interactive. But if you really knew me, mm-hmm. if you saw this thing inside of me, whatever it is that I'm ashamed of, you wouldn't be that way. So I'll keep up the facade, but in a way, I have withdrawn, and I'm not allowing you to connect with me. And so shame is something that we do to ourselves through a perception or a conception that we have taken in.
It's so wild to hear you say that, because this is like word for word the language that I was using in my cord cutting ceremony. As I was like I was literally talking to younger versions of myself. There was a narrative that I wanted to cut with this conception of myself through time, that like the secret that me and all these younger me's have is that we're actually not good people. Mm. And we've tried really hard to be perceived as good people our whole lives, but like no one knows us like we know ourselves. And also I think it comes from a religious upbringing that like I've always been afraid of cosmic justice, of like karmic justice, that like the universe or God or whatever is going to come for me and because of my deficiencies and my character flaws. So I try to beat it to it. I'm like, don't worry, I got it under control. I'm handing out enough justice to myself. And it's so interesting because like I think what's fascinating about it is that people, whether they've committed first degree murder or whether they've just lost their temper and yelled at someone, have that same response of deep down, I know that I'm morally, ethically deficient in a way that makes me unworthy of love, that makes me unworthy of happiness, that makes me unworthy of forgiveness, that makes me, you know, and if other people are willing to forgive me, that's for them. That's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to hang on to this. I'm going to make sure I hold myself accountable. For,
I know when I work with people, if, you know, me being an artist, I look at it and I go, if I could depict what you do to yourself every day, it's a crime scene.
Yeah.
If you could see the inner narrative playing out outside of yourself, it is a crime scene.
Yeah.
And the only difference between somebody that commits murder and somebody that murders themselves every day is somebody that still feels some connection in the world to other people.
Yeah.
You know, that's, and it's really that simple, because a lot of people, when I was inside, you know, administrators and people that were trying to build programs like I was building in there would go, well, what is it that, you know, how is it that people experience shame, but then they don't go out and harm somebody like that? And I go, well, the difference is that if your shame is so all encompassing that you don't feel any person, if they knew you, then you're so defensive and you're so vulnerable and you are so weak that you have to ramp up into this world where you would rather, you know, die or hurt somebody else than face this feeling.
Yes.
And you know that if you allow somebody in, that ultimately it's like a narcissistic injury. It's something that will challenge your cohesion of self. You know, so that is something that nobody can face on their own. And as human beings, we need other people to cope with our pain and our trauma. And we need to know that somebody else does see us exactly how we are and accepts us how we are. So if you don't have some measure of that in your life, then that crime scene comes outside of you. But it's the same crime scene.
Right.
Think of that inner narrative. Oh, you're stupid. You're dumb. Imagine if you saw somebody talking to somebody else like that.
Right.
You are an idiot. You are dumb. Don't, what are you doing in this room? All of that negative. If you saw it outside of yourself, it would be a crime.
Well, I mean, literally, we talked about like how you encounter different reactions when you tell people about your story. And when, you know, for me, you know, I've been in AA for the last 4.5 years. And like, I've gotten so used to hearing everyone's, this is who I was before I was in here. Everyone's stories about the worst things they've ever done and about all the people they lied to and cheated and stole from and hurt. And it's always been, and my last week's episode was about forgiveness. And I talked about this spectrum of people who are really good at forgiving other people, but not so great at forgiving themselves. And people on the other side of the spectrum who are really great at letting themselves off the hook for things. But like, if you cross them, they're like, no, you're out of my book for, you know, they hold really great at holding a grudge. And then obviously there are people in the middle who are good at both, or bad at both. but like, you know, I lie on the spectrum of I give other people so much leniency. So when I met you, I was just like, oh, I'm so fascinated by that. didn't even cross my mind to be like, wait a minute,
right.
Person's not deserving of my trust.
Yeah.
Or I just was instantly like, oh, I got to know more about this. I need to hear more from you. I hold no one to a as like, I don't hold anyone to the standard that I hold myself to, where like you could tell me that you killed 20 people and I'd be like, oh, so fascinating. And then you like, you rehabilitated from that. And I'd be like, but I'm still worse than you because
whatever it is,
because of the, I just know my inner mechanism so much better. And I've gotten so used to, so accustomed to, hanging on to my own shame. And that's, it's sort of like become a part of my identity. Yeah. It's, and so this, I mean, this cord cutting thing was wild to be like, oh, can I actually try to move forward from this and out of this? You know?
Absolutely. And it is something that we can step out of. And unfortunately in our, you know, society, like shame is so wrapped up in our identities and the way that we present ourselves and people's belief systems and how they want to present, that a lot of times they rob themselves of a life of fulfillment, well-being, and they oftentimes define themselves by how far they put somebody else down. They are more elevated the more that I'm not this, so I'm up here. You know, as long as that juxtaposition is present, then they aren't at the bottom of it, and so therefore they feel elevated, you know. And I would say that, you know, I think it's really amazing when people are like yourself that allow people their mistakes and the level of harm that I have caused other people is something that I do consider a lifelong debt, you know, and it's something that I think there is, I think when somebody comes in touch with their humanity, when I finally got through those barriers and got to who I was and could feel my pain, I immediately, as a human being, related to all the pain that I've caused, and I can't express more clearly how in that moment there's no greater consequence than that. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing that will drive you more and give you more compassion and empathy for others than to really sit inside of your own mistakes and your own things you can't change for someone else, and to realize that it came from a place that was all yours. It's all your fault. There's nothing that can mitigate that. And though I think that there's a huge difference between shame and guilt.
Yes.
Okay. So shame comes from without. It's something that other people bring into you, and it's a social mechanism. And it's needed for certain levels of social interaction. The difference between positive and negative shame is when you can earn your way out of it. If you are ashamed of something, like, oh, you know, you ate your boogers or something, it's like, oh my God, you know, that's really nasty. You know, like, oh my, he ate his booger, you know, like, you know, oh my God, I'm ashamed of myself. I just ate a booger. Right. So like, if somebody does that and then, but then they can earn their way out of it. Like, oh, he was a booger eater, but now he's not a booger eater. Right. And I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, he used to do that, but now he's great. He doesn't do that anymore. You know, like there's something that you can redeem yourself with. Well, then shame compels you to fit in and creates what we consider a culture or a society. Right. So there's this spot in there to where it's kind of like teaming up and adapting to your environment. And there's almost not necessarily a healthy element to it, but it's part of who we are as human beings when we socialize.
Yeah.
The negative part is when we don't feel, or it is a cultural standard that somebody cannot come back from something, no matter what it is, you know, that as a public narrative locks somebody into that shame. And there is a responsibility in that narrative. You know, if you do something, if you burned your pancakes, and I'm like, hey, somebody that burns their pancakes, there's something wrong with that motherfucker. He cannot come back from that.
Yeah.
That, you're a pancake burner.
A certain kind of, you know, person.
Yeah. You burnt your pancake. I've never burned no pancake. You're a pancake burner. That's it. And so if I do that, I'm actually locking you into something that you may or may not be anymore.
Right.
And when you understand that by me locking you in that narrative, I'm actually creating the antithesis of what I want, which is cohesion and community, right? Mm-hmm. So there is this balance in there. So guilt is what we want to see in people, which is through their compassion or through their empathy, they feel remorse for what they've done, and that spurns an action.
Right.
It causes interconnection. So this is kind of like where the seat of my coaching sits, is that I view all trauma, to the narrative of it, where it comes from, no matter where it is situationally, is the notion or idea that you are no longer connected to the people around you.
Mm.
Period. All trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And all healing is the notion that you are interconnected and accepted by the people around you.
Okay.
That is the goal that every therapist, every psychologist, every person that's working with somebody that is in a state of trauma is trying to get the epiphany of that truth for them.
Okay. I'm like, this is really good stuff. This is like, I need to hear this stuff. Did you ever encounter people, or do you ever encounter people in your work today? But I imagine on the inside too, that you meet people who, because I've met people like this in AA. I've sponsored guys like this who like can tell me all these things that they've done wrong in their life, but it's through a lens of like, I don't think I did anything wrong. Mm. Like, here's a thing that happened. I did this thing to this person, but like this person crossed me and fucked up. And I feel like you and I sit closer on the same spectrum of like, we're pretty decent at like holding ourselves accountable to maybe to a fault, where it's like, don't worry, I got it. I'm sitting here, I'm feeling the remorse. But do you ever encounter people who like you have to work to get them to that place of remorse?
Absolutely. Every person, including us, had to work to get to that awareness at some point, whether it was earlier or later in our lives.
Sure.
I've sat in circles. I mean, I was in a level 4 prison, so all that was really around me was murderers and, you know, people that had done really awful things. And I created these groups where we wanted to make amends to the people we had harmed, or, you know, there's 3 types of amends: direct amend, indirect amends, and living amends. Right. And you know, any one of those is a very humanizing experience for somebody once they actually have compassion and empathy for the people that they've harmed. Mm-hmm. The key to that process, and I mean, I've sat in a circle with every single guy was in there for taking a life, and you go, and they would walk up to me afterwards, some of them, and go like, you know, I know this is about amends and giving back to the people that I've harmed, but, you know, between you and I actually don't feel it. I don't feel remorse. I feel like they deserved what they got. They, you know, he did this or whatever.
He killed my cousin and I killed him, and that's balance.
You can't commit a crime like that and not believe in what you're doing. Okay, mm-hmm. that's the truth. It doesn't mean your thinking is correct, but inevitably every person that was in my group that stayed the course came to a place of true compassion and remorse for what they have done. Mm-hmm. And the way that is found is that if I cannot address my own pain, I cannot relate to yours. Your humanity rests in the idea that you can feel your pain. You cannot feel your pain unless you have a support group. You cannot feel your pain if you can't step outside of your shame and be courageous enough to say, this is the thing I'm ashamed of, and then find acceptance. It is a very exact and very clear healing process that every person can achieve and can maintain in their life.
Wow. That is really powerful. You cannot address another person's pain until you address your own. You need to.
There's no real empathy there. There's no way for you to have compassion for somebody else if you can't shut off one emotion. So if I feel pain and I shut off that emotion, I also lose my joy, my respect, my love, all of the other emotions in my spectrum, and my senses become my emotional surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
This replaces what I'm shutting down emotionally. That's why everybody always says, I feel like a zombie, I'm numb, I don't feel anything. And they hurt themselves, or they do things in their life like drugs or violence or adrenaline junkies, or they do something tactile to replace that loss of the emotions,
mm-hmm.
right? So if me as a person, if I can't feel, if I can't get through that and feel my own pain, there's no way, if I have all my emotions shut off, that I can empathize with you as a human being, because I don't actually have the capacity to connect to you, because I'm not connected to myself. All of my tools are gone. If I feel my pain and I find and I push through that shame and I get to a place of acceptance, I immediately am in a place where I am empathetic and compassionate. It is instinctual. You do not have to create it. It is present within that person automatically.
This has been the great realization of this year for me, like the work that I've been doing. I talked to you about this a little bit earlier, that like I had this idea that I'm in therapy to learn how to beat my fear,
right,
to get over my fear. not, and I didn't start this process understanding that I was carrying shame about my fear. I don't think I was in that there yet. But the big revelation is that, like, oh, it's not about learning how to live without fear. That's impossible, first of all. That's just not part of being an emotional being, you know, and that's sort of like, I used drugs and alcohol for years and years and years to just, like, anytime I felt uncomfortable, can we just numb this out? Can we just tamp this down? Can I just get out of the discomfort that I feel? Even if I know that what I'm doing is just setting it up to be worse tomorrow because I'm just pushing it out, you know, numbing it down, and it's going to come back. You used a great analogy about, if you cut your finger, what the purpose of pain is. And that's sort of like the big revelation of this year is, like, what is the utility in all of these emotions, in pain, in fear, in even in shame? What is the utility of these things? Rather than trying to get rid of them, I need to feel these things in order to be able to address them. Right.
Definitely. And more importantly, you have to respect and appreciate them. It isn't like, okay, I'll accept the fact that this kid made this decision, me at 8 years old.
Yeah.
You have to look at it, though it's, you know, because what you're talking about is like cognitive dissonance, right? You have an instinctual urge from childhood that doesn't meet the cognitive urge of today that's not lining up, so they conflict, right? In that scenario, this part of the cognitive dissonance, the emotional, very unarticulated, overwhelming, all-consuming fear or anxiety that's trapped inside of this space, is like that cut that we talked about. Mm-hmm. It's going to keep getting worse if you don't tend to it. It's going to get infected. It's going to get into your finger. It's going to get louder and louder and louder until it is tended to. And what it wants is to be seen and understood. It doesn't want to be corrected. It wants to be seen and understood.
Or numbed. It doesn't want to be numbed either. It doesn't want just a little shot that takes out the... Because we could do that too.
Well, that's what drugs and violence and everything else
is. We could give you a shot in your finger that makes it not hurt so bad, but that's not going to address the infection.
Yeah, you can make it as numb as you want. It's going to still turn into a sore and get worse and worse and worse.
Right, right.
And so the only way that it really evolves outside of that space is if you talk to that child and go, first of all, think of how amazing it is at 8 years old. Most of us have our real, you know, stuff that sticks with us, you know, around, you know, in 7 to 10, you know, like in that area, that little pocket's a sweet spot for our trauma to linger that we're aware of anyway. And inside of that space, if you really think about it, you've lived a life with the ethos that an 8-year-old made and somehow survived and, like, did all of this. Like, really think about how powerful that little 8-year-old was to come up with something that got you this far, that helped you survive. Like, look at that kid with respect. And this came to me this way, so I ask other people to do it. Look at an 8-year-old. Find an 8-year-old around you or whatever age you were traumatized and look at that and go, that child made this decision and overcame whatever that trauma was and got me to this point. Respect that kid.
Yes.
Look at him and go, like, oh my God, that, what an amazing kid to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And then acknowledge it and say, you know what? I don't want you to go away. Of course, you're part of me. I don't want you to go away. What I need you to understand is that we don't have to do it that way anymore. Mm-hmm. So I'm not telling you to go away. I'm welcoming you in. And you know what? Now we get to do it this way. We're safe. We're okay. I have this mind that I got. And so we're going to team these things up with each other, and I'm going to bring you to the present so that I'm not trapped in the past. So it's not pushing parts of you away. It's bringing it in and absorbing it and allowing it to be true to itself.
Yes.
That's the journey.
That was a big part of the ceremony that I did too, is like realizing, like, oh, you guys all result, like, and letting them know, like, look, you actually helped us get here.
Yeah.
And in a very exciting place. I'm in a very exciting place in my life currently. There's a lot, and it's a lot of the work, and also realizing the utility of things, like we said, like realizing that my anxiety always kind of precedes either a challenge that I need the extra energy for, or something really exciting that I can't see yet. And that's how it always goes. And so I'm like trying to view the last couple of years as like, oh my God, I might be getting prepped up for something even more exciting than I can even imagine. Yeah. And sort of that reframe and stuff. And it's very exciting, but I had to go and look at all these younger versions of myself and go, thank you for finding a way through. Thank you for not giving up. Thank you for not quitting. Thank you for sticking it out. I know there were times when you wanted to quit. I know there were times where you felt like man, this is more pain than it's worth. But like, I mean, we talked about this too, that even when you start making these realizations and these connections, like I was in this room talking to my younger selves and feeling like I'm the unified version of all of them. I am like the higher self right now. Mm-hmm. And I also know that this is just for now, that I'm going to walk out of this room and I'm going to be back in the world and my ego's going to be back and things are going to pop up that irritate me and I'm going to be right back into my bullshit. Yeah. And I'm going to have to continue the work. It's not a one and done thing. Like once you start realizing this stuff, you realize, oh, I'm in this for the long haul.
Well, and that's an abstract idea that a lot of people, once they have made that leap of faith and that tremendous courage it takes to face their shame, and they do connect with themselves and others again, is they run into the misconception that you're not going to feel pain again. You get the privilege of feeling all of your emotions when you get to feel, right? So some of that's pain, some of that's disappointment, some of that's betrayal, some of it's love, kindness, acceptance, all of these wonderful, there's this cornucopia of emotions that many of us don't have the acuity because we've shut down at such an early age that there's a learning curve to it. But the idea that we don't get to feel pain isn't the truth. The truth of it is that we should see those things just like that finger. Those things are actually pointing to our enlightenment. They're pointing to the next step in our journey that's going to fulfill us. Because if something is calling our attention or something that is overwhelming, that's when we, instead of pushing it away, the lesson is to know that there's an answer in this that is going to fulfill me. It's going to heal me, and it's going to call me to my best self.
You're such a remarkably well-adjusted and emotionally articulate person, Christian. It's like really, really wonderful to hear you speak about this. And like, just, I my God, I want to like take a course from you and have you train me in this. You spent so much of your life in such a difficult environment. I just am wondering, was there a stretch of time where you weren't doing this work, where maybe you were just like deep in resentment I mean, how from, because prison's not a fun place.
No, and it's definitely is not. It is not. And it's not a therapeutic place. Nothing about it is rehabilitative. I mean, nothing traumatizes you more than prison, you know? So like, it's designed to be humiliating. It's a penance. It's a penitentiary. It's designed to punish you. Right. And you know, punitive segregation, the whole idea is that you are punished for long periods of time as harsh as possible, right? And that's the public narrative. And we're not talking about that today, so we're going to go into the shame. But like, the idea is that for me to have found that in there was really just, but that's what gives me the ability to believe that every person, minus severe brain damage, like physical damage, has the capacity to come back from their trauma. Mm-hmm. And if you saw me back when I was a kid, I mean, I was a dangerous, psychotic kid. You know, like I was really, like when I went to prison, it didn't change me one bit. I just got worse. You know, the first 3 or 4 years I was in there, I was thrust into the most violent prison in California at the time, Salinas Valley State Prison. It just opened up. It was a hellhole. I mean, I was, you know, 21 and full of shit, and I was going for it, you know? So like I knew I was going to die in prison. So there was no hope. There was no intention for me to be a good person, quote unquote. So I found it through my humanity, through the idea, like I said, that when, believe it or not, even when you're at your worst, you're doing your best. And this is a strange concept.
Ooh, okay? That's good.
On your worst day, in that moment, you're actually doing the best that you got. That's your very best. No one ever truly tries to fail. You're trying to get out of that hole. Mm-hmm. And when you have that realization for yourself, it gives you deep compassion for others, because when they're having their worst day or having their best moment that doesn't really sit so well with you,
yeah,
it gives you compassion to know that that is where it's coming from, that they're literally on their last leg. They're cutting the last thing, ties to people they have. They don't have the capacity to function anymore, and they're doing the absolute best they can. So for me, even though it was very ugly, I was doing the very best I could inside of that space. And when I realized that I was unhappy, that I didn't feel good about what I had done in my life, and that I didn't trust anybody, that I didn't love anybody, that I didn't have the capacity to trust or be you know, what I knew I could be. Some deeper part of me was calling me to that, you know, and thankfully I lived long enough to start stepping outside of that. But the beginning of it for me was art and expression and exploring, just asking that question, who am I? What do I feel? What is my purpose? You know, those ideas evolved into some really deep and rich experiences for me, even in that, you know, really hostile and violent environment.
I was just going to ask about that. At some point you start doing like a painting class, right? And teaching guys and having like galleries and showings. Like, how does that come about? How do you get the permission for something like that? And how does that tie into the work around shame?
You know, I was very fortunate to kind of stumble upon this yard that was a very progressive yard. And it's one of the only kind that existed in California. It actually changed a lot of the prison system to date. Almost all the guys that were commuted were off of this yard and one other yard in California, right? And there's 33 prisons in California, over 170,000 inmates, you know, and only so many, you know, people were even given this opportunity to come home. So in that space, I was very fortunate to be in a place where the majority of the yard was life without the possibility of parole prisoners, meaning we were never going to go home. So we had 600 beds on that yard because two of the buildings, 400 of the beds were ADSEG, administrative segregation, and we didn't have access to those buildings. But these three buildings, 400 of the prisoners there were life without the possibility of parole. So we actually ran that prison in that yard. And because we weren't going home, we stopped doing the prison politics that lent into the idea that we were animals and all we could do was kill each other. And we were like, we started asking those questions. What can I do to give back? So I got involved with a group that a bunch of LWOPs had created that I stepped into called ASH. It was Artists Serving Humanity. And they gave every year to the Toys for Tots Club. They gave to a battered women's shelter. We would put the art out in the street and do a fundraiser for them. And then we just started teaching other guys on the yard how to draw and do things. So it was kind of a community-based idea. But the idea in that space was very simple. It was about giving. What are you giving and why are you giving it? You know, and I think the biggest sign to me that somebody is healing is when they have the urge to give.
That's beautiful.
It's the truth. It's just, is if I'm working with somebody the first time they go, you know, I wonder what I could do to help that person. You're there. That is the biggest sign that somebody is starting to connect to their true self, because you know, you're interconnected with everyone else and you feel their loss.
Yeah.
You have compassion for them. Right.
Yeah.
So that space was a tremendously impactful space for me to give to others and to try to, develop a narrative. The lady that was coming in that was doing arts and corrections at the time, she challenged me in a way that I had never, because I was a technical artist. So I do portraits and like very, you know, it's clinical almost, you know, like it's just it's a skill set.
Yeah.
So she begged the question to me, well, what are you trying to say? What does your art mean? What does it say? Right. And I was like, well, it means that I can do a portrait. What do you mean? You know, like it was a foreign idea
means,
to me. Like,
look, I drew this apple. Well,
exactly. You know, and as a prisoner, the last thing somebody ever asks you is, what do you think? And what do you have to say?
Yeah.
That's not something you're going to get asked as a prisoner. So that was such a foreign idea to me. It evolved into me understanding just how powerful it was to ask those questions. And as I evolved through my journey, that particular art room shut down because they took arts and corrections out of the CDCR, California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. So when they took that out, me and probably seven or eight other life without the possibility of parole prisoners that were involved in that program asked the captain of the yard if we could have a room to do this art and that we would fund it ourselves.
Wow.
We would buy our own supplies. We would give all of our art away. We just needed a place. Now, in prison, a place is not a small thing. For them to give us that space was a huge testament to how much they believed in us, because they were like, totally, you guys have already been doing good things. And it was a program that made the prison look good, so they allowed us to have this space.
Yeah.
And that place became a nucleus for, because we didn't allow gang activity in there. We didn't do drugs in there. We didn't allow the negative aspects of prison into that space. There was no racism allowed in that space. There was no boundaries other than the desire to communicate our life experience and to share with the community.
And, like, the other guys, like, guys who do want to be racist or have gang activity, like, they, like, were respectful of that?
Well, they knew they couldn't come in there, and we were tough enough to hold that down, you know? So, like, yeah. like none of the guys in there were pushovers. These were all guys that, you know, everybody, but there was a lot of people that wanted to be in the space because it was a privileged space. I mean, not, like I said, not many people have a room that they call their own. And we had it 7 days a week. We could go in there, and it was just our spot. It was like a club almost, you know, like we could sit in there and talk and philosophize, and people were going, you know, we would study books and discuss, you know, heavy things, share our life experience, run groups, you know, we built a lot of programs that allowed other people to step outside of their trauma and acknowledge what their experience was, you know. And as people went through those processes, we encourage them to put it on a canvas, to build a sculpture, to hey, we have this event where people are going to hear about you. What do you have to say?
Yeah.
And that changes it. Like, I could draw a piece of paper and throw it on my shelf. Like, that doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
Now, if I draw something and you're paying attention, all of a sudden there's all of this energy and intention, and I'm going to be seen.
Yeah.
They dig deeper. There's that human connection, and the meaning of art is expression and acceptance, or at least reception, you know, like they receive what it is that you are trying to say, and you are seen.
Yeah.
So it became a very, very powerful place, and a place where we all evolved in ways that we never could have without that space.
You start to have a stronger sense of identity again, and you start to feel like a human being again. And that's maybe the first start part, feeling like a human being in a place that's designed to dehumanize you, feeling like a human being again with, like you said, someone asking you, what do you want to say? What are you trying to say? That's maybe a great tool into getting into starting to address the pain so that you can start to, like you said, you can't address the harm and the pain that you've caused other people unless you can look inward. But a person who is regularly dehumanized might even be so detached from their feelings that they don't even have access to any of that. So getting in there through art, I think, is so fascinating. This is the part where I'm like, this is very Andy Dufresne, like getting them to give you the space and everything. Very, yeah.
Well, and the fact that the sole impetus about building this space had nothing high-minded about it other than to be in this space, you had to want to give. That was the profit of the space. So defining the people that participated by that narrowed it down to 10 or 15 people, like literally out of hundreds of thousands of guys in the prison. Like you're talking. So for that to be the criteria of the space, that really changed the narrative of the conversation. So when we're in the room and I go, what could I possibly tell the people that survived my crime? Because I went in for murder, attempted murder. Somebody lived through my crime.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And what could I possibly say to this person that could help them live better, even though I'm dying in prison and he's dealing with that pain and that loss of a friend, his best friend that I killed? And to look at that and go, like, to ask a group of people and to go into that in a real way and say, and to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
To go, the only thing that I can give somebody that I have harmed that deeply is compassion and true understanding of where my trauma came from and then how I passed it on to you. Because trauma reenactment is so personal and type specific. And I'll give you an example of this because I don't know if I shared this with you or not, but he ended up coming in and we did what they call a victim offender dialogue where I talked to the guy that I shot and tried to kill several times. You know,
I wanted to talk to you about this because you have a great story with this guy too going forward.
And like we talk on a day, like a weekly basis. He's literally my best. He's my best man at my wedding. Like the guy's amazing, right?
It's wild. It's right? So wild.
But at this time it was just a concept. And more importantly, it was actually illegal for me to reach out to him. I could not reach out to him and ask to do that. It wasn't legal for me to do it. So when I built this group of amends and we took this idea from the art room and it was like, what could we do to give back to the people we've harmed? The answer was, because trauma reenactment is so personal, that if you do the work on yourself, if you actually take that leap and step outside of your shame and connect and bare your soul, and I'm talking lots of tears and lots of pain. I mean, it is probably the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
And others that I've worked with. It's their crowning achievement in life is facing this thing that is overwhelming. you then have a very intimate understanding about what they need in a conversation from you to heal. Because when you pass it on to them, it's the same exact way. And the way that I can describe it, because I know it sounds abstract, is say I'm a kid and somebody punches me in the face. What happens in that moment? I hit the ground. I know I'm weak. You're strong.
Yeah.
Right? So if I don't want to feel weak,
I have to get back up and punch you back.
Well, I'm going to act like you because you're strong. Yeah. I want to be strong. So now I'm going to imitate exactly what you did to me to be strong. That's how trauma reenactment works. So if you verbally humiliate me and I feel small when you talk down to me, well, I'm going to verbally humiliate you.
Ooh, so I know about that.
Right. Yeah. So then we trauma reenact exactly what happens to us to other people. Okay. So in that, and it isn't a one-off, like, you know, like it isn't, you know, like it, but the intention of the work is that you're doing as a person that's trying to survive is you're trying not to feel weak and powerless. So the only thing, so if I heal from that punch in the face and I go, God, I felt so humiliated when everybody laughed. And what I really needed to hear from somebody is that you're actually strong. You know, you got up and you didn't take it out on your family, or you didn't do this, or you did, like, I needed this in this scenario. So if I'm sitting down with somebody that I punched in the face, I can sit with them and go, first of all, truly ask, what do you need from me? And have it available for them. But also going into it, knowing that they need to be affirmed in this area, and they need to know that they didn't deserve this, and they need to understand they had no responsibility in this, and they need. So you have this really deep understanding of what their real needs, the deeper needs that they need to heal, and that I caused this shame in you and you didn't deserve it.
Yes.
You know, yeah. And so there's this really intimate understanding that happens with that knowledge that came from that art room, you know, that space, and it was able to give to him. And now it's flourished into our family's healing, and we actively, go out into the communities and help other people. And I mean, it's really amazing. But to give an extra example of that, so I did a home invasion murder robbery.
Yeah, like, I just want to make sure, like, people heard that correctly, that, like, the person that survived your crime was the best man at your wedding.
Yes.
Like, it's great. You were going into this, yeah.
So that's the testament of this healing process, is that it takes something that would be a lifelong injury, overwhelming pain, you know, severe trauma. He used to wake up every year at the anniversary of the crime and with terror, night terrors and body sweats and, like, physical trauma.
Yeah.
And now that isn't present anymore. He has the capacity to, be his true self, which is an amazing, kind, generous, truly remarkable guy. And if I called him right now, he'd answer the phone and talk to you. I mean, like, that's how close we are, right?
I mean, you guys were kids. Like, you were both kids.
I was 19. He was about 20 when I attacked him. But to show that the value of trauma reenactment, he literally went out and committed the same crime I did to him 4 or 5 years later. And went to prison for 10 years because of that crime. So he went to a house to collect money on a drug debt. His buddy shot the guy in the leg. They went to prison for that.
And very similar to what
you... It was a home invasion, two guys going into a house. I mean, it's identical because I had a co-defendant.
Yeah.
So he went, I mean, it's the mirror image of what I did to him that made him feel small, that made him feel overwhelmed, that had this created this great loss in his life. He literally did the same exact thing I did to him.
My God.
So trauma reenactment is so personal and it's so intimate. And if we ever really want people to overcome this pain and trauma that they have, it's very helpful to have the people that are involved, all people involved in it, healing and being present and giving what they can to one another if they can feel their pain, find support, and help each other.
God, the story is, it's so good. It's such a powerful story. You see it so acutely. We see this with domestic abuse, with child abuse. Like, with sexual abuse. Like, we see this a lot. Trauma reenactment and people doing what was done to them. And this is, you know, it's not, in that sense, it's not unique. But what is so wonderful and strong and inspiring about the story is the way that both of you work together to get to a place where you're now like, actively helping other people heal
yeah.
as well, and that your lives have become so service oriented and just such a testament to the proclivity and ability for people to grow and learn and change and evolve through pain, through difficult things. Something you talked to me a little bit about when we met on that rooftop is, and again, I think this is, we could go into territory where we're talking more about the rehabilitative system, but I just want to touch on this a little bit. You mentioned that you're in a place that's full of people who are not to be trifled with, potentially scary people, but you said that some of the scariest people that you're in there with are COs, are correction officers.
Definitely.
And it's because they have a job
yeah.
that requires them to daily dehumanize people. And I wonder if you experienced, I know you talked about the experience of having them come and see some of the artwork and stuff. And like, I wonder about the shame that goes into that job, and unaddressed shame. Like, they have a job where the state and the government are telling them that it is their duty to sort of treat people in a subhuman way. And so the cognitive dissonance that must be going on in a person who's being told, well, it's my job to do this. It's my job to dehumanize this person. But I can't help but go home and think, I don't know if I feel good about what I just did to that person today at my job.
I feel like it's such a human function that it doesn't have to be prompted. Just like, you know, punching somebody else after you've been punched, it's just human nature to become what they become. And that's why they have the highest suicide rate after retirement of any profession.
Yeah.
Because it is toxic for them to do their job. We would watch somebody come in normal, and it took about 3 months, and then they were fully on board with the way that the prison system, and it only gets worse
yeah,
for them.
Yeah, you probably saw people come in with the best of intentions.
Oh, they
that
did.
They're thinking, I'm coming in here because this is a noble profession,
yeah.
and you watched it
degrade inside of their mind. Yeah. And what it is that they're not ready to deal with what we lived in every day was the, you've taken every socially inept person that is extremely angry and overwhelmed with their life and does not know how to support themselves or anyone else, and you put them all in the same place.
Yeah.
That's prison,
yeah.
right? No normal outlets. You cannot walk away. You're mm-hmm. stuck on a football field living with these people. That's what the side of the yard's a football field.
Yeah.
That's it. You got 1,000 guys on a football field trying to make it live. So they come in as an officer, and I think that they come in with the right intentions. They come in and they don't have no one has the ability to sit inside of that space, that type of toxicity, and try to maintain control with and see the person that they're dealing with. And especially such an abstract thing, they aren't educated. A lot of these people are not educated people. They, you know, they have a GED. They went through high school, and that's it. They don't have any training as clinicians, as psychologists. They don't have any comprehension of what they're actually dealing with. They're just trying to survive it like everybody else. So they get humiliated. They get fucking ran over. They try to be nice and get worked and made to look bad, or that the narrative, we prove the narrative true by being abusive to them.
Mm-hmm.
Or they see somebody get stabbed to death, or somebody, you know, they get it very quickly that we are animals not to be trusted, and that if you do trust them, you're an absolute fool. And 9 times out of 10, they prove that right, because
yeah,
it's
yeah.
a very hostile environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it is toxic, and it is, I think it's human nature to guard yourself. I mean, look at the Stanford experiment. They weren't even in prison.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they took peers and just gave them authority over another human being, and it immediately went to shit. You know, mm-hmm. so like, it's just human nature. If you give, you know, what is that saying? You know, power tends to be absolute, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so there's just no way around it. If you give yourself control of another human being, there's going to be abuse.
Yeah.
And the most important part, I think, to take away from it is that it's ineffective. It does not change the trauma cycle. And when you actually have a comprehension of what trauma is, that feeling of separation,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of what it takes to heal that, nowhere in that process does a penal system fit the narrative of transforming our communities into safer places, and where people that have been hurt by other people actually get an opportunity to heal.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's at the very least ineffective, and at the worst, another crime that's being committed
sure.
in our communities.
Sure. Did you ever have these guys come and look at the artwork and the work that you were doing and go like, oh my God, like,
oh, yeah.
these guys are really onto something here.
Well, you know, like that, the truth of it is that that place couldn't exist without their support. Nothing happens in prison without an officer's approval.
Sure.
So there were officers that believed in us, or at least believed in the money we were generating to give to the community.
Yeah.
So we were considered the exception to the rule. So there was like all the people seen here, and then they were like, okay, you guys are a little above that, but you're still not a human being, but you're doing good things, so we'll facilitate you. And then ultimately, because of that space, and only because of that space, that art room that we had developed, we had a place to really demonstrate the potential of what we were doing in our lives and how that was something that the community needs to be a better community.
Yeah.
What the community is losing by keeping us incarcerated inside of that space. And I believe that that's why we were given another chance.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. I think I need I was telling you that I've been putting a lot of new artwork on my walls, and yeah. I think I need a Christian Branscombe.
Well, you got it, man. I'm matter of fact, I'm going in to start one of the guys that I taught inside that ended up staying behind because he has 50 years to do in prison. He was a young kid from Compton that, you know, had a gang shooting. And, you know, I met him when he was in his 20s, you know, early 20s. And now he's in his mid-30s and, like, he's doing the same thing that we did together over there. And he's building another art room in another prison and he's creating awesome. This space, right? And so I'm going in to do that. And not only will I be doing some art for that you could definitely grab and or I would gladly give to you and you could come see their work, you know, like their voice and give them an opportunity.
Oh, well, I'm happy to pay for it. Is there a place? Do you sell art online? Do you have a website or a...
You know what's strange is that since I've been home, I haven't done, like, I just had, like, this is what I do, right? So, like, I'm so actively, so this art project is actually one of the, I've only done, like, 3 pieces since I came home. And those were to people that I wanted to just, you know, it's kind of like you're saying, they wanted a piece of the history of what we were doing, right? And so... For me, it's going to be a joy to get back into this project, do some art from this side of the fence, because the world looks very different to me today. And the journey, like yeah. the art will be much different than it was there because it was so focused on, you know, trauma and like what shame is. And like we did 450 square foot of art that we did in an exhibit that I still have that was just about shame and how that translates into crime in our communities and what it is that, you know, the community needs to know to heal that. And like, what is that narrative and how do we change it? And, you know, so yes, I'm just now starting to get back into art as something that is a vehicle to express what's going on in my life today and more so them.
Did you say 3 years?
Yeah, I just 3 years of my anniversary last, the 23rd.
And you got married in that time
yeah.
and you're doing all this work. This like how have you had you've done so much in 3 years, it feels like.
I've been, you know, I mean, when I say I'm fortunate, I mean, it's miraculous level. Just, I am such a blessed person. And I honestly don't even know how these things manifest in my life other than I feel like being truly present in our lives, being genuinely vulnerable and inviting in the opportunities that may be uncomfortable for myself or others to have a real opportunity. That is the give of my freedom. It is yeah. the purpose of my freedom. I feel like destiny is like an arc. You can't just, you know, like some, I mean, me to be sitting here is so unlikely. I mean, unlikely is an understatement. It is almost impossible.
Yeah.
And for me to be sitting here, that trajectory says that I have something that I am supposed to do or that I'm meant to do out here in the community, or I wouldn't be sitting here. So every day is a reminder to wake up and ask that question. What is my purpose? What do I have to offer other people? And how can I connect in a way that allows them the mercy that I received?
Yeah.
How can I give that to other people?
Well, I feel so enormously privileged to have met you on that rooftop and to have you sitting here in my apartment. It's like such a wonderful gift to get to talk to someone who understands this in such an acute and unique way where, I mean, it's just, it's like, it's the right timing for me in my life right now. I hope it's the right timing for listeners and for people who are, you know, like, I feel like if I can help boost or broadcast your message in any way, and help, you know, magnify your purpose in this new phase of your life. It's so exciting. Are you going to like write a book or something? Like,
well, I've been asked too many times, and I'm sure it's coming at some point. I feel so driven right now to really clarify the,
you seem so like uninterested in like capitalizing on this. Like you really just,
I, you know, it's kind of strange because just as it was for me inside, like we created a lot of revenue and we did a lot of things, but like the things that, one thing that the takeaway from prison for me is that I know for me that I'm a purpose-driven person, mm-hmm. and that for me, my payout is always seeing it passed on, you know? And so anything that comes into my life, whether it be a book or movies or like the things that they've asked, I look at it in the context of like, is that going to further what this message is and what this purpose is?
Yeah.
And when that clearly says to me, like, this is going to help people outside of that space, or the clarity of this is really going to give people the opportunity they need to step outside of their pain or to feel some, to give them that impetus to make that leap, then I'm going to make the leap too, you know? So I feel like everything that I've ever needed comes into my life at the right time. And I believe like, just as much as me sitting here with you, meeting you on that random rooftop and like talking and like us being on this journey together, I feel like all of these things speak to the way that life works when you live a purposeful life, mm-hmm. you know, that it's designed to be connected with the people around you in an intimate way that really changes the quality and the purpose of it.
I absolutely believe that. I really do feel like the more that I'm intentional about being open with the direction I'm being pulled by whatever it is in the universe that's pulling me through, I just continue to see that like I'm really being taken care of even when it doesn't feel like I am, and I'm really being led to places that are there intentionally for my growth and for a purpose, and like that we are all sort of like, and also the, you know, the whole idea that we're not separate and that we are all collectively experiencing these different forms of shame and trauma, from really massive egregious ones to little teeny tiny ones, and that like we're getting that spectrum intentionally as the conscious appendage of the universe, you know, that we are, that like it's all part of us collectively understanding existence a little bit better.
Yeah. I often say to people when they're like, well, what is, you know, what is it that you're seeking, you know? And it's always understanding. Mm-hmm. Because there's no, and it's very Zen in a way, is that being present is the end result of this work. Because trauma puts you in the past. If you do something and I go back to the past, I'm in a traumatic state. Mm. If I go to the future, I'm in a hypervigilant state.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of trauma, right? So if I'm going like, oh, well, this might happen, this might happen, this might happen, I'm in the future. Mm-hmm. So if I'm in the past or if I'm in the future, I'm in a state of trauma. Mm. So if I'm present and I'm actually interacting with you real time, I'm actually taking in all of life. Wow. Not avoiding it in the past and in the future, being afraid or overwhelmed by the shame I have, right?
Yep. Wow. Just, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Because I know, obviously, that being in the present is where I want to be and that's where power lies. But to actually hear it as that like being out of the present is being in a state of trauma, that's really powerful. There's so many good sound bites that you brought today, Christian, that we're going to be able to mine this thing for gold.
dig it up.
Is there anywhere that people can find you if they want to work with you? Or
yeah, I have a website, ChristianBranscombe11, or actually it's just ChristianBranscombe.com, myname.com, and you can go to my website. And I do coaching for people that are, you know, through a lot of different things. Depending on what you want to work on, I can work with you on it, definitely.
So cool. I just, again, thank you so much for carving time out of your day and coming and sitting
my pleasure.
In the heat and sharing a bit of your story and a bit of your perspective and experience with me and with the listeners.
Well, thank you for sharing me with the people out there, and I genuinely appreciate our chance meeting, and I have no doubt that there's a lot of purpose in it, and I'm very grateful for it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Christian. I mean, did I tell you or did I tell you? Just, man, I talked to Christian for another hour after we stopped recording, and I think I'm just going to have to keep talking to this guy. I want to have him back on the show to talk about other things, to talk maybe about, like, the concept of hope. We talked about that. I was telling him over and over again that his story is so Andy Dufresne and Shawshank Redemption. I was like, have you seen that movie? And he's like, oh, yeah. My aunt says that's like my movie, you know. But I'm like, he was literally telling me about how early on when people would talk to him about like finding more purpose in your life and what are you going to do with your life now that you're in here, or trying to inject hope, or his aunt would say to him, I just know one of these days you're going to come home. I know that you're going to come home. And he would say like, don't say that to me. I don't want to hear that. That hurts me to hear. Like, it's that thing from The Shawshank Redemption where Morgan Freeman tells Tim Robbins' character, hope is a dangerous thing. And these are people who are in a situation that is, for all intents and purposes, hopeless. Hopeless. Hope has been stripped. This is going to be the rest of your life, and there is nothing you can do about it. I mean, did you hear that? He was the first commutation in California state history from a person who was not in law enforcement. Like, this does not happen. And he got there. He was telling me the coolest thing that, like, he used to tell guys that he worked with on the inside. It really comes down to when people walk in here and they see you and they look at you and they meet you, what do they see? Do they see somebody who belongs in here? Do you look like, do you feel like, do you carry yourself? Do you have the energy of someone who is supposed to be in this place? And the sad truth is that in his experience and what he's relayed to me and what he relayed on this podcast is that, yeah, actually a lot of people who are in there do carry themselves that way. And we could go into the reasons why that is, that they are in a place that, you know, as we talked about, is not conducive to mental health, is not conducive to, like, it's not therapeutic. These people aren't, it's not designed so that these people are growing and evolving spiritually. It's designed to take a person who's in a bad situation and make that bad situation worse. To take a person who's already in a bad mental space, a bad spiritual place, and grind that down to nothing. So, you know, when Morgan Freeman says that hope is a dangerous thing, it's like, yeah, I'm in a hopeless situation. You know, hope is a scary thing. Somehow, Christian became in that space a person who, when people walked into that prison, they looked at him and they said, this guy doesn't belong here. He transformed into a person who no longer belonged in those walls and who is now sitting in my bedroom telling me his story. It's so crazy. I was sitting across from this guy just going, I cannot believe I'm talking to this person. This person went into prison in 1994, y'all. Here's just a short list of things that happened between 1994 and when he was released. The Matrix came out. That movie happened. Every Star Wars movie after the original trilogy, the Bush administration and the controversy of the 2000 election, whether Bush won or whether Gore won, that whole thing, the Bill Clinton controversy, like that whole thing, every school shooting from Columbine to Parkland, like the whole epidemic of school shootings in America happened while he was in prison. Those colored Macs, remember those? When Mac came out with those Macs that were the big boxes that were see-through that were colored, those happened. iPods, the rise of the internet and the invention of social media like MySpace, Facebook, none of that stuff existed in 1994. Cell phones barely existed, and the proliferation of cell phones from the Nokia block to flip phones, razors, smartphones. 9/11, y'all. 9/11 was 7 years after he went in, and the entirety of the Iraq-Afghanistan war, the election of Barack Obama, and the entirety of the Obama administration, the election of Donald Trump, the Mars rover, the creation of the Large Hadron Collider, the reconnaissance. You know that period when Matthew McConaughey was doing a bunch of Oscar-winning roles, the reconnaissance? That happened. Pretty much the entirety of the MCU up to Endgame. The MCU, this thing that revolutionized Hollywood, that maybe changed Hollywood for the worse, that maybe is killing Hollywood, who knows. For a time, it looked like one of the most amazing things that had ever happened, like one of the most amazing accomplishments in the history of cinema, that this like 22-movie-long saga that was like this most expensive TV show ever made that was very successful looked really amazing. And now it looks like maybe it's like, I don't know, contributing to like the death of movie theaters and the death of cinema. We'll see. But so much stuff happened in 25 years, and in that time, Christian Branscombe evolved and changed from a person who belonged there to a person who did not belong there, and to the person that you all heard today. And it's fucking remarkable. He is a remarkable person. I am so honored and thrilled and privileged to have met him and to have had that conversation with him. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for being here. That's it. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com. Y'all, you got like 2 more days to order my album on vinyl on Bandcamp if you want Bandcamp to fulfill your order. You have 2 more days, and then the campaign is closed. So there's 2 more days to go to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, order my double vinyl. If you want that order to be fulfilled by Bandcamp, if you want like a signed insert from me or any of the perks that come from ordering it with the campaign, you can do it then. Otherwise, you can buy it from me after that from just like my merch store on Bandcamp. Patreon.com/AustinArcher. Shout out to the Patreon patrons. We love you so much. Really, genuinely love you all so much. This does not happen without you. Each and every one of you matters so much to the daily workings of this operation. Thank you, thank you, thank you. If you want to join them, Patreon.com/AustinArcher. I think that's everything. Love you all so much. Take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.